looking at Matthew 26 and following. This part of Matthew comes right after the Olivet Discourse, which we studied 2 weeks ago. The Olivet Discourse is the message Jesus gave to his disciples on the Mount of Olives, briefing about the future. And it's very complicated and powerful and worthy of a great deal more study. What I suggest today is that we finish Matthew, which is about the last week in the life of Jesus, and then maybe next week, God willing, let's look at Luke, the last chapters in Luke, to see the things that the way that Matthew and Luke are complementary in the sense that they share the same events but from a slightly different perspective. Okay? Chapter 26. It came to pass when Jesus had finished all these things, namely the Olivet Discourse, he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified." The Passover was Friday, and the night before there was a meal called the Last Supper, and the next day Jesus would be crucified on Friday. "You know that after 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified." The trial of Jesus, which lasted all night long, will be in this next section. So it's Wednesday now, and 2 days later would be Friday, or Thursday. Now, actually, Friday starts with sundown on Thursday. That's the Jewish calendar runs from sundown to sundown. I'm confusing you. Then, so at any rate, Jesus comes down from the Mount of Olives and is busted in the Garden of Gethsemane and given an all-night trial and taken out and crucified on Friday. At least I think it's Friday. Others would say that he was crucified on Thursday or even Wednesday. The Jewish days, a part of a day counts as a whole day. So if Jesus was crucified on Friday, day number one is Friday, day number two is Saturday, day number three, which starts at sundown on Saturday, is the third day. So to have Jesus crucified on Friday and raised from the dead on Sunday morning is conventional interpretation. So we now move right into the arrest and trial of Jesus. The chief priests, the scribes, and the elders of the people assembled at the palace of the high priest, who is called Caiaphas. The high priest in the temple lived kind of high on the hog, and so he's got a nice home in a nice part of town. And the priests and the Pharisees and Sadducees are conspiring to get rid of Jesus, as you know. They plotted to take Jesus by trickery and kill him. So they had to do this as an undercover job because Jesus was so popular with the people, and they dared not alienate the people. They said, "Not during the feast let there be an uproar among the people." So we don't dare make a false move with all these 800,000 people living here plus a million or more from out of town, because there are all kinds of people in Jerusalem, but Jesus was very popular with the people. "Not during the feast let there be an uproar among the people." When Jesus was in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, we don't know who Simon the leper was. Jesus could have been visiting her for dinner, probably invited over for dinner. We know so far he stayed overnight in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he also tended to go out to Bethany at night and stay with friends. So we don't know anything more about Simon except that he had been a leper, presumably a cleansed leper. "A woman came to him," to Jesus, "having an alabaster flask of very costly, fragrant oil. And she poured it on his head as he sat at the table." A vial of rare oil like frankincense or myrrh would have been very, very expensive because of the very rare spices. And so she comes in while they're all at this big U-shaped table. having dinner, seated on their hands and knees, seated on their backs. The tables are U-shaped like this, and you don't sit on a chair, you sit around the table with your feet pushed out back. So the disciples are indignant that such a waste of expensive fragrant oil should be poured on Jesus. That's, oh Lord, that's a waste of money and oil, and wouldn't it have been better that fragrant oil might have been sold for much money and given to the poor? Wouldn't you think that the best use of this oil would be to sell it and take the proceeds and give them to the poor people? When Jesus was aware of it, he said to them, "Why do you trouble the woman? She has done a good work for me. For you have the poor with you always, but me you do not always have. For in pouring this fragrant oil on my body, she did it for my burial. Assuredly, I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be told as a memorial to her." Well, that's 2,000 years ago. Millions of people have heard about this story, and so this woman is getting honored a great deal down through the centuries. And it's a fitting to pay tribute and respect to somebody who's going to die in the next couple of days. You can't honor them after they're dead and gone. At funerals, we usually try to honor the deceased, but it's too late. It's give me the roses while I live. Useless, the flowers that you send after I'm dead and gone. An old Carter family tune. All right. Then, now we get another disciple. This is Judas Iscariot, leaves the meeting and goes to betray Jesus for money. He went to the chief priests and said, "What are you willing to give me if I deliver him to you?" They counted out for him 30 pieces of silver. So from that time, he, Judas, sought opportunity to betray him. Well, they knew who Jesus was, but Judas, the disciple who betrayed Jesus, goes and asks for money from the chief priests, money under the table, because he has secret plans to buy a property in Jerusalem, and he's planning on being very famous when Jesus succeeds and becomes the king. And so there's this conspiracy part going on. 30 pieces of silver could have been as little as 30 denarii, which would be, denarii is a day's labor for a worker. It probably was a lot more money than that. It was a down payment on a real estate investment, probably. And in fact, Judas probably already had the plot picked out. He might have even put a down payment on it, and so he needs more money to close the deal. And so the chief priest says, "Well, thanks for your help. We'll work with you so that we can arrest Jesus at the right time when the crowds are not aware of where he is." So, on the first day of the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, the disciples came, saying to him, "Where do you want us to prepare for you the Passover?" Probably Thursday. And Jesus said, "Go into the city to a certain man and say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.' So the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover." Interesting that Jesus somehow had made arrangements to rent a room, a banquet room, probably the upper room, and he wants to have a dinner party, so he's arranged all of this in advance. He's arranged for food and everything with the owner of this piece of land, and he says to his disciples, "Go signal the owner of the property that we're ready for the feast." Disciples did as Jesus had directed them when they prepared the Passover. So the disciples go to this upper room and prepare dinner. They bring in catered food, or they get togo sandwiches or whatever, the standard spread, and it's all set out because Jesus has having a little dinner party all of his own just for his 12 disciples. So we come to the Passover. We find that all 12 are gathered together in the upper room, and a lot of people are there also as bystanders, probably not having dinner with them. And the first thing that Jesus does which is not here in Matthew, is that he washes the feet of the disciples. And that shows that he's a servant. It shows that he takes off his garment, girds a towel around himself, and washes the feet of the disciples, which is outrageous for Peter and so on, but that's in another one of the Gospels. It's incredible that the guest of honor, the Lord, is washing the feet of the disciples, and we are told to wash one another's feet in a similar way. The King of the universe washes feet. And while they're eating, they sit down and have this meal. It's a buffet on the table. And Jesus says to the group, "One of you will betray me." And they were all exceedingly sorrowful. Each of them began to say, "Lord, is it I?" So each one of these 12 disciples was very puzzled, because they all 11 of them wondered if they had betrayed Jesus inadvertently. Well, there's one man that has betrayed Jesus, and that's Judas, who used to dip into he kept the money, the money and the credit cards for traveling around the country, and he would buy food and so on. So contributions would go to Judas and go into his purse, and he would pay the bills, as it were. But he keeps dipping into this treasury and putting it in his own pocket. So he's a cheat here. And Jesus says to these bewildered apostles, disciples, "Is it I?" they say. He answered and said, "He who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to the man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he'd never been born." So he says, "I have an appointment with destiny tomorrow, and I'm going to die for the sins of the world." The disciples didn't believe that, but Jesus knew. And this is ordained by God from the foundation of the world, but the person who cooperates with the devil in this conspiracy is doubly damned. It would be better that he'd never been born. So that's where human responsibility comes in, and God's sovereignty. Judas, who was betraying him, had been for 3 years, answered and said, "Rabbi, is it I?" Well, he knows he's the guilty party. And Jesus says, "You said it, man. You have said so." So Jesus doesn't say, "Yeah, it's you. You're guilty as all heck." He doesn't do that. He just says, "Yeah, it's you." Jesus knew all along who would betray him. The others didn't know that. The other 11 had traveled with them, with Judas and with Jesus, everywhere. Judas went out when they evangelized. Judas seemed to know everything that's going on, and yet he's the betrayer. You can't tell who's a betrayer when you're among other Christians. Sometimes that's how subtle betrayal is. As they were eating, Jesus took bread, dipped it, and broke it, and gave it to his disciples and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." There was a sauce on the table, and you would take what's equivalent of a fork. You'd take a stick and put bread on the end of it and dip it into this sauce, and then you'd eat it. And that way you'd get this rich gravy on bread, and it would be very nourishing. So Jesus said, "Look, I'm going to dip this stick in with bread on it, and I'm going to give it to the guilty party." He's right over there. And Jesus does that, and that's a clear sign that Judas is exposed. He's been found out. Here we have, "Take, eat, this is my body." Some translations say, 1 Corinthians 11 say, "Take, heed, this is my body, which is broken for you." But the "broken for you" is not in the Greek. So it's there's nothing here about Jesus being broken at this point. It's simply his way of exposing Judas. Then, so this is where we get the Lord's table. Then he took the cup, which is wine, he gave thanks and gave it to them. Drink from it, all of you. This is the blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission, the removal of sins. But I say to you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until the day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. So this is a meal that Jesus has longed to enjoy with his disciples, away from the crowds, away from all the clamor and hassle and interruptions. It's an intimate meal, and it comes on the night of the betrayal of Jesus. That's why at the table of the Lord, which we celebrate in church, we make reference to this passage, as in 1 Corinthians 11, and celebrate what we call the Lord's table, or communion, Holy Communion. And it's a solemn event because we remember this very event in the life of Jesus. I say to you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until the day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. So I'm going to see you guys in 2,000 years, and we're going to all sit down and have this same commemorative meal together, all of us. And so I'm sorry to keep you waiting. That's the idea here. When they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. You didn't know they had hymns back then. Well, they used to sing from the Psalms of Ascent and from the Psalms which had been set to melody. And so we don't know what that hymn was. It wasn't out of our hymn books, and Howard could play for us, but one of the Psalms. The Psalms are very beautiful when they're sung with a harp or whatever. Jesus said to them, all of you will be made to stumble because of me this night. You guys think that Judas is going to screw up. Well, the rest of you are going to screw up too. Every single one of you is going to betray me and forsake me. And so I know that ahead of time. I'm going to the cross alone. A few women will hang out when I'm dying, but the disciples will flee. And this is a fulfillment of Zechariah 13:7. Where God says, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. So that's a prophecy that God himself would strike the shepherd, that's Jesus, and his disciples would be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee. So Jesus says, don't worry, I'm only gone for the weekend. I'll be back on Sunday, and I want to meet you guys all in Galilee. And we'll have fish together in an intimate fire. In fact, Jesus cooks the fish. We get that later on. So Jesus, in a sense, sees beyond his agonizing trial and crucifixion and torture, and he sees to his resurrection as inevitable. It's going to happen. And he sees that he's going to have a new body. He's going to be able to travel up to Galilee easily and enjoy the fellowship again with his disciples. Peter answered and said to him, even if we're all made to stumble because of you, I'll never be made to stumble. Whoa, that's impetuous Peter there.
Never say never.
Peter said to him, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. And so said all the disciples. Oh yeah, Lord, we're with it. We're with Peter here on this one. We will never deny you. No, come hell or high water, we're not going to be intimidated, and we're not going to deny you. We're loyal to the end. See that bravado. And we'll see how that turns out. And then Jesus came to them, with them to a place called Gethsemane, and said to his disciples, sit here while I go and pray over you. At the foot of Mount of Olives is an old olive garden of ancient olive trees. You can visit it today. Jesus often slept in there overnight there in that garden. He went there oftentimes to pray. It's a beautiful garden today. And so this is a very special place where he could meet with his disciples and be relatively private and sit under these enormous big olive trees. And Jesus says, okay, I've got to go pray. And I want James and John the sons of Zebedee to go with me. We met them earlier because their mother pleaded for special handling, and Jesus said no. Jesus wants a couple guys to go pray with him. He doesn't invite all of them. He invites James and John, with whom he had a very close, intimate relationship. Real good buddies. And he said, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me. So he says, look, I'm going to go through a huge ordeal in prayer here. And would you guys hang out with me? You don't understand what I'm going to go through, but I sure would like some friends along with me. I'd sure like to have some company.
Yeah.
So, interesting what happens. He went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, saying, oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. So, the agony that Jesus is facing here takes the form of crying out to God, if there's any way that we can avoid the ordeal that lies before me, find me a way out. And that shows that he already knows something of the suffering and the agony that lays in wait for him the very next day. It's evening now. Okay, so naturally his two disciples go with him and are happy to comfort him. No, not at all. They go fall asleep. He came to his disciples. After a while, Jesus comes back from this solitary prayer meeting, and here's James and John and all the disciples all sleeping. Well, they've had a long day. It's nighttime. It's getting time to go to bed, and can't we wait till tomorrow, Jesus? And obviously, that's not in the time program. And so Jesus finds them asleep, and he wakes up Peter, and he says, what? Could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. So I know it's tough for you to hang in with me. I wish you guys could hang in with me if you just knew what was going on inside me. He goes a second time alone. Jesus goes back up and resumes his prayer. Oh, my Father, if this cup cannot pass from me unless I drink it, your will be done. So this is a deeper level now of intimacy with Jesus and God the Father, in which he says, Father, Father. So he's calling out to God as the God that he's always had a relationship with from eternity. The intimacy that Jesus had with God is what the prayer gets deeper.
Lambert, in verse 41 it says, watch and pray lest you enter into temptation. What do you think that temptation might be? What do you think that temptation might be in 41?
The temptation would be to shrink back and say no, or to find some way out. If you have a great ordeal waiting you tomorrow, you might like to take a vacation and fly to Hawaii instead, or you might like to go home and have a drink, or you might want to forget about it. And what you face is an incredibly terrible ordeal that calls for your obedience in every fabric of your being. I think that's...
The temptation would be to not do God's will.
Yeah, that's good. Not do God's will. Third time, verse 42 and 43. My Father, if this cup cannot pass away from me unless I drink it, your will be done. That's number two. Number three, he came and found them asleep again. Their eyes were heavy. Disciples didn't wake up. They just went back to sleep, apathetic and indifferent. So he left them. He's all alone now. He goes up into the most agonizing time of prayer. He prayed the third time, saying the same words. Then he came to his disciples and said to them, are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. So Jesus knew very well that there was going to be an immediate set of things happen to him that very night, maybe 10 or 11 o'clock. He's not going to get to have any sleep. Disciples already having a nap, And then Jesus says, hey, you guys, wake up. Rise, let us be going. See, he who betrays me is at hand. Look, if you can see what's happening, you recognize Judas there. He's on his way. While he was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, with a great multitude, with swords and clubs, came from the chief priests and elders of the people. His betrayer had given him a sign, saying, whoever I kiss, he is the one, seize him. Immediately he went up to Jesus and said, greetings, Rabbi, and kissed him. This great crowd would be soldiers, armed. This is not just a couple policemen showing up at your door. This is a whole bunch of... And Jesus has no weapons. He's not going to resist arrest. He can call on all the angels, but he doesn't. So this is one innocent man in the garden with a few friends, and he sent half the police force in Jerusalem out to get him and arrest him. And everybody could know who Jesus was. But Judas is the guy leading them to the garden. He knew that Jesus hanged out there often. And so Jesus has brought the priests and the temple law enforcement squad to the Garden of Gethsemane. And Judas says to the soldiers with him, the guy you're looking for here is over here, and I'll go kiss him on the cheek. That's the kiss of betrayal. We talk about the Judas kiss. It's kind of well known. There's several kinds of kisses in the Bible. There's erotic kisses. There's the kiss of lovers. There's the kiss of affection between family members. Very common in the Middle East to kiss somebody on the cheek. It's nothing erotic about it at all. To kiss your brothers and sisters on the cheek is legitimate. Well, this is the betrayer's kiss, where you're showing love and affection to somebody that you want to get killed. Immediately, he went up to Jesus and said, greetings, Rabbi, and kissed him. And Jesus said to him, friend or comrade, why have you come? Judas knows perfectly well why he's come. But he makes this kind of public announcement. Hi there, Judas, why are you here? Maybe he's clarifying it for the crowd. They came and laid hands on Jesus and took him. He did not resist arrest. And imagine a whole squad of policemen coming to bust one innocent man. Suddenly, one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. Well, who is it that's acting impetuously to step in and stop all this? Well, Peter, of course. We know that from one of the other Gospels. And he has a sharp knife, and he goes up to the servant of the high priest, his right-hand man, and cuts his ear off. Bloody, violent, painful. And Jesus rebukes Peter and says, put your sword in its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Violence is not going to solve this problem. You're not helping at all, Peter. I am going to bring in the kingdom by nonviolent means. That's where we get the idea of nonviolence. Put your sword back in its scabbard, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think that I cannot now pray to my Father and he will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels? How then could the scripture be fulfilled that it must happen this way? So, Jesus restores the ear of, it was cut off. He takes the cut off ear and puts it back on the bleeding head of this kid and heals him instantly. And so, what Peter screwed up with, Jesus fixes it because so we can get on with the program. In that hour, Jesus said to the multitudes, we've got a big crowd now, have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to take me? I sat daily with you teaching in the temple and you didn't seize me. How come you didn't bust me earlier? Well, obviously Jesus knew that the crowds would be very unhappy with this popular teacher being busted for no good reason. In fact, Jesus was exposing the hypocrisy in all of his teaching and preaching. The kids liked it, the common people liked it, and the Pharisees hated it. So this is totally unfair all the way. But it's a fulfillment of many, many predictions in the Old Testament that when the Messiah came, this would all happen to him. This was done that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled. Then all his disciples forsook him and fled. That's what he predicted. And so the disciples now, the 11, are terrified at what's happening to Jesus. And do they go with him to jail? No. Do they hang in and say, hey, anybody speak up for Jesus? No. They all run away and talk back home to Mama. They go hang out with their safe, secure place. And this is a very sad thing. Exactly what Jesus predicted would happen. Those who had laid hold of Jesus, that's the arresting soldiers, led him away to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. This is a late night meeting. You don't ordinarily get all the council of high priests and elders assembled for a meeting in the house of Caiaphas at midnight. But this is a big deal. Now, Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard, and he went in and sat with the servants to the end. So Peter has enough bravado to follow the whole crowd and hang out in the courtyard at Caiaphas' palace. Other disciples all fled home, but Peter, I think, still wants to help out if he can, but he doesn't want to be seen or he wants to be inconspicuous. The chief priests, the elders, and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. At last, two false witnesses came forward and said, "This fellow said, 'I'm able to destroy the temple of God and build it in 3 days.'" Not the temple building, it was talking about his body. These false witnesses have been hired to lie. In the law of Moses, if you're going to charge somebody, it takes at least two witnesses. The testimony, the accusation of one man is not sufficient. "Yeah, I saw him kill that guy." And the other witness says, "Yeah, I was there too. We swear on a stack of Bibles that this is the guy." Well, that's lying. That you can pay somebody enough, they'll lie in court for you. They'll tell lies. "Oh yeah, I saw this happen. I was there." So that happens to innocent people like Jesus. All right. And Jesus did say that his body was going to be killed, his was the real temple, and be raised in 3 days. But he did not destroy the temple or threaten to destroy the temple. Threw the money changers out. But Jesus kept silent. He did not answer his accusers one word. That's pretty awesome. The high priest arose and said to him, "Do you answer nothing? What is it that these men testify? What is it that these men testify against you?" But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest answered and said to him, "I adjure you by the living God that you tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." "Swear on a stack of Bibles, Jesus. Tell us if you really are the Son of God." And he shut up, didn't say a thing. Except he did say in verse 64, "It is as you said." Yeah, I'm the Son of God, so that's common knowledge. "Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven." So this story is going to have a very different ending than you suppose. Now, you're not getting rid of me. You're going to kill the body. I'm going to go away for a while. When I come back, I'm coming back on the clouds of heaven with glory, and we will have a great courtroom hearing. And this time, the tables will be turned. The high priest tore his clothes. Ah! Furious, he's angry that Jesus would say such a thing. pulling the rug right out from under the priesthood. The high priest tore his clothes, saying, "He has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look, now you've all heard this blasphemy. What do you think?" They answered and said, "He is deserving of death." So everybody goes along with the false witnesses. Caiaphas, the high priest, is instigator, and so he says, "Well, all these charges are surely true, though they come from paid false witnesses." They spat in his face and beat him, and others struck him with the palms of their hands. So you don't treat an accused person in court that way. You can't go into a court of law and go and beat up the accused or insult him or spit on him. The judge won't allow that. But here it's kosher. They have already made up their mind about Jesus. Doesn't matter who he is. They spit in his face and beat him, and they slap him with the back of their hands, saying, "Jesus, prophesy to us, Messiah. Who is the one who struck you? Ha ha ha, you're a prophet. Tell us who, name us the ones that have been striking you. Ha ha." So there's mocking. Peter, meanwhile, out in the courtyard, listening to all this going on, is Peter. And he's not talking with the guys. He's talking to a servant girl. And she said, "Oh, I know you. You also were with Jesus of Galilee, Peter." Peter denied it before them all, saying, "I don't know what you're saying. Not me." That's the first of Peter's denials, which Jesus said would happen. Now, a little later, when he had gone out of the gateway to the gateway of the court, another girl, not two big, rough, tough men, but two girls, saw him and said to those who were there, "This fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth. I was up in Nazareth. I saw Jesus there, and he was hanging out with Jesus. And Peter was hanging out with Jesus, and so that's true, probably very true, but so what?" Again, he denied an oath, "I do not know the man. I don't know Jesus." After a while, those who stood by came to him and said to Peter, "Surely you also are one of them, because your speech betrays you." Your accent, maybe, but somehow something about your denial here is phony. We don't believe that. And Peter began to curse and swear, saying, "I do not know the man." He began to swear like, "God help me," or "I swear by the Bible," or "I swear by the Almighty God," which would be to get God to back up your oath. He's calling on heaven to back. That's a very bad thing to do. Not a good idea to invoke the name of God to defend you when you're all messed up. So he may have sworn in terms of "God damn it," or something like that, but it probably was just, "I swear in the name of God that." When this happened, immediately a rooster crowed. We know now that the night is gone in this time, and it's getting to be daylight, about 5 a.m. probably, when the sun begins to come up and it starts getting light. That's when the roosters wake up and crow. I don't know if you've ever been around chickens, but roosters crow to show their control over the hens and their domination. And rooster crowing is very, very noticeable if you're on a farm. Peter remembered the words of Jesus. Uh-oh. Jesus said, "I would betray him 3 times. Before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. And Peter is cut to the core. He said, he went out and wept bitterly. We know from the other Gospels that he poured his heart out when he realized that he had betrayed Jesus, denied him 3 times, humiliated himself, denigrated the name of Jesus, and no other disciples around, they're all gone. Okay? more? When morning came, chapter 27, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. So we've gone a whole long night without sleep. It's now morning, and business is starting in Jerusalem. And the chief priests and elders of the people plotted to, they had a big meeting to say, how are we going to get rid of this guy, Jesus? We had all these trials all night long, but we've talked long enough. We got to kill this guy and do it right now. So the Jewish people at this time in their history did not have any legal authority to kill anybody. They were under the rulership of Rome. They did not have any sovereignty of their own. They did not have any courtrooms of their own. We've just seen the Sanhedrin and the religious courts, right? But they had to go to the Romans to get permission to execute anybody. And Pilate's the guy in charge. Pilate is an honorable Roman ruler over the whole country. A reasonable guy by ordinary standards. But he doesn't like to get involved in the nitty-gritty affairs of these Jews, who are always cantankerous and difficult. When they had bound Jesus, didn't need to be bound, but they did, delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. So we take a little interlude here at verse 3, because here's a little note about what's happening to Judas while this is all happening. Judas, his betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned, was remorseful. Well, it wasn't real remorse. Judas probably liked Jesus, didn't want to see this man die, didn't think that his 30 pieces of silver transaction was going to result in the death of Jesus, but he's not repenting in the sense of, oh Lord, forgive me. He's just full of remorse because he didn't get to hang out with Jesus anymore if Jesus is dead. He was remorseful and brought back those 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders. So he had 30 pieces of silver in his pockets, burning a hole in his pockets. And he took the money back to the chief priest, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. They said, what is that to us? You see to it. So the religious authorities want no part in this now, so they give, they take the 30 pieces of silver from Judas and throw them on the floor. He threw down the pieces of silver and the departed, Judas does, and he went and hanged himself. Judas committed suicide. We know elsewhere that he went to his property in south of Jerusalem and found a tree there and hanged himself. We know also from one of the other Gospels that nobody would take his body down from the tree where he'd hanged himself. And out in the hot sun, it finally rotted away. The body rotted away and fell on the ground and his bowels gushed out. So this is a dead corpse. Nobody would touch the guy. The betrayer is God. And of course, he dies on his own piece of property, the property that he was trying to buy. The chief priest took the 30 silver pieces and said, it is not lawful to put them into the treasury. They are the price of blood. Blood money means that you have been hired to do some dirty deed. They took counsel and bought with them the potter's field to bury strangers in. Therefore, that field has been called the field of blood, Academa. Get that. It's still there today. It was fulfilled what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, they took the 30 pieces of silver, and the value of him who was prized, they of whom the children of Israel priced, and gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me. So Jeremiah had been told to act out this very scenario 600 years earlier, which we saw in the book of Jeremiah. And so the transaction of Judas here And these events are predicted by the prophet Jeremiah. And now, so this is a little side episode. That's, we left everything, the flow of things back at verse 3. So we're back with Pilate again. Judas stood before the governor. Jesus stood before the governor. And the governor asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "It is as you say, I've been called the king of the Jews." When he was being accused by the chief priests and elders, he said nothing. So he's honest with the governor. He does not engage the chief priests who come along to turn him over to Pilate. Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" He answered them not one word. The governor marveled greatly. "Oh, I've never seen such a thing. I've never seen an innocent man fail to confess, fail to defend himself, and Jesus is keeping quiet while all this accusation is going on. And these Jews have brought this man to me so that I could make sure that he's the right man's dying." And Pilate is amazed at Jesus. This is interesting. We don't know a lot about the later life of Pilate. Some people think that he later became a believer later in life. And we know a little bit about his life, and that's entirely possible. We find out elsewhere that, we'll get to that in a minute.
I think MacArthur teaches that he actually ended up killing himself because he was so distraught over killing Jesus.
That's a possibility. I didn't read up on the what we know about Pilate, but we're going to see something here about his wife. Verse 15. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to releasing to the multitude one prisoner whom they wished. To show goodwill toward the Jewish people, the Roman rulers would release a prisoner at Passover time to show that they were kind and merciful. They were being lenient. They knew these Jews were troublemakers and they wanted to appease the Jews by finding a criminal someplace and pardoning him. You know, like a governor does when he goes into a prison and pardons a condemned murderer and sets him free by executive authority. So, there is with the accusers of Jesus a very well-known bad guy, a prisoner called Barabbas. Barabbas is a proven guilty man. And Pilate now has the choice. Do I execute Barabbas, who deserves to die, or do I set Barabbas free, or do I kill Jesus? I got two choices here, obviously, between a good man and a bad man. And Pilate's probably going to lean in favor of releasing Jesus and letting Barabbas go be crucified. But he knew that because of envy, they had delivered him. While he was sitting on his judgment seat, his bima, his wife said to him, saying, "Have nothing to do with that man. I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him." So here we know that Pilate's wife, probably a very caring, compassionate, sensitive woman, was troubled in her dreams when she heard about Jesus. She heard about Barabbas. Maybe she was present. And she said, "Pilate, my husband, I've had these nightmares about Jesus. You better not get involved with him." That's a good wife's advice. The chief priests and elders persuaded the multitudes that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. So that at this time, the crowd, led by the priests and scribes, argue that Barabbas should be released and Jesus crucified. The governor answered and said, "Which of these two do you want to release to you?" They said, "Barabbas." That's really pretty important. When the Savior of the world comes in to die for the sins of the world, and you have a chance to prevent that or to make a better choice, and you say, nah, heck with that, Jesus. He's a troublemaker. What does it matter about Barabbas? Let's kill Jesus. So this priests and the scribes have persuaded the people to collaborate with them, and Pilate is the guy who has no choice, or he doesn't realize he has no choice. And Pilate says in verse 23, when the governor said, why? What evil has he done? Yeah, I didn't find anything wrong with Jesus. My wife was concerned about him. I want to turn him loose. They cried out all the more, let him be crucified. When Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, he's going to have a riot on his hands if he doesn't go along with the crowd. A tumult is arising. He took water. He said, he's up on his platform here, and he calls for a basin of water and washes his hands. I wash my hands of this man, that's what he says. And it's symbolic, but I wash my hands of this whole affair. Leave me out of it, you guys. All I'm doing here is being a good Roman governor. So the people answered and said, his blood be on us and our children. He released Barabbas to them, and when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. So this is very, very interesting. His blood be upon us and on our children is a very serious pronouncement of the in which Jesus says, you guys are guilty for whatever follows. I wash my hands of this whole thing. And then you would think that he would detach himself from the whole thing, but he didn't. He says, well, beat Jesus badly, beat him to a pulp, and then I'll release him. So scourging is to take a whip of cords with little bits of bone embedded in it, and to beat a victim on his back until he bled and tore the skin and very nearly was killed. And this is what Pilate allowed to happen to Jesus, or caused to happen to Jesus, and said, okay, that's all I've done with Jesus. Well, obviously you don't do that. Even to a condemned prisoner, you don't beat him. The soldiers of the governor, Pilate's soldiers, took Jesus into the Praetorium and gathered the whole garrison around him. They stripped him of all of his clothes, probably naked, put a scarlet robe on him. When they had twisted a crown of thorns, they put it on his head, a reed in his right hand. They bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews. So this is a mocking of Jesus. They put on a royal robe draped around his naked body. They put a crown of thorns over his head, push it on down until the scalp bleeds, and they say, this is our king. This is our king. An absolute, total mockery. And they spat on him. They handed him a reed, and they struck him on the head. So they're total humiliation for Jesus here. When they had mocked him, they took the robe off him, put his own clothes back on him, and led him away to be crucified. So they put on this little circus for the public here, humiliating Jesus completely, emotionally. When they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. Him they compelled to bear his cross. Simon is from Ethiopia. He's a black man. Paul mentions his son in the book of Romans. So this guy was a believer, a big, heavy-duty black man, and they said, hey, look, Jesus is pretty weak and broken right now. Would you carry his cross, please? Because we got to take this cross out to the place of execution and let Jesus stumble there with whatever little strength he has. When they had come to a place called Golgotha, which is a name that means place of the skull, they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink, but when he had tasted it, he would not drink. Golgotha is probably outside the Garden Tomb in Jerusalem, I think so. And if you go there today, on the cliff face, you can see what looks like a skull.
This is the same place Abraham took his son Isaac to be sacrificed? Is it the same place where Abraham took his sons?
Yes, I think it is. I think it's exactly the same hill where Abraham offered his son Isaac to be crucified many years earlier, 2,000 years earlier. I think it's on the very same spot. In popular tradition, the crucifixion of Jesus took place outside the city wall to the west. Jesus was buried in what is now the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which Helena built about 300 A.D. I think that the Garden Tomb on Mount Moriah is the real place. You can go there today. The British have set it up into a wonderful little park, and believers go there all the time in Jerusalem. And there is an empty tomb there. All right. Then they crucified him and divided his garments, casting lots, that it might be fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet. They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. That's from Psalm 22. And crucifixion was a way that the Romans got rid of their enemies. Sometimes they crucify hundreds at a time. They were crucified naked. Jesus did not probably have a loincloth on. He was probably naked, which is maximum humiliation. The Romans were brutal. Crucified victims would often dangle in the sun, hot sun, for days before dying. Jesus died in 6 hours, as we'll see, but the Romans popularized crucifixion as a way of giving maximum torture to a condemned man and letting him die in terrible agony. Ordinarily, the hands were nailed separately to the wooden beams through the wrist, not through the palms. If you nail through the palms, you'll tear out. If you nail through the wrist, the victim can stay on the cross and push him, pull himself. Also, the legs are probably crossed and a single nail is driven through the feet so that you retain the ability to hang on the cross and to breathe in and breathe out and hopefully push yourself up with your feet. And it's an agonizing way of torturing somebody to death because they get weaker and weaker and weaker and finally die of asphyxiation. As I said, it could be several days. This is the most painful way of killing somebody. And the Romans didn't care. They wanted maximum object lesson for the people, keep the people subservient.
Lambert.
Now the soldiers were very happy to take Jesus, strip his clothes off, nail him to the cross, and then they sit down and wait for him to die. So they sit down at the cross. Now, in those days, the condemned prisoner's clothes were auctioned off. Jesus had a beautiful outward robe that had probably been made for him. He had inner garments, t-shirt and shorts and things, but we don't know exactly what, but he's naked and his clothes are on the ground at the foot of the cross, and the soldiers bargained for those. They are unable to tear this big outer robe, and so they have to get rid of that as a valuable piece of clothing as one piece. But the rest of whatever he had on, sandals, no socks, but whatever he had on, you just sell it to the highest bidder, and there he is naked. So you've stripped him. And they put up on his head, so over his head they nailed this board, and it was written in three languages. I was going to try to copy that, print it out for you guys today, but I have a good article on my website called 6hours.html, which summarizes the 6 hours of Jesus on the cross. And after that article, I have something by Chuck Missler, which goes through this inscription that's very, very careful. And the Pharisees did not like what was written. They tried to get Pilate to change it, but he wouldn't. Well, what I've written, I've written. Sitting down, they kept watch over him, and they put over his head the accusation reading, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews," in three languages, as I remember. Two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. You got to get rid of some criminals. Always somebody around to crucify. Now the crowd passes by. This probably happened on the Damascus Road, just outside the gates of Jerusalem, at eye level, not way on a high wooden cross, but probably right at the place of the skull. You'd go there today, and the traffic in and out of Jerusalem would go right by this guy at eye level, and they'd see anybody else that had been crucified at eye level. And so this is not some private affair. It's as public as you can make it. "Those who passed by blasphemed him, wagging their heads, serves him right, and saying, 'You who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross.'" Hey, Jesus, if you're really the Son of God, you wouldn't let this happen to you, and you would miraculously get down from the cross and go on about your business. But evidently you're not the Son of God. "The chief priests, mocking with the scribes and elders, said, 'He saved others, himself he cannot save. If he is the King of Israel, let him now come down from the cross, and we will believe him.'" I'll believe it when I see it. I don't believe Jesus is the Son of God unless he proves it by coming down off that cross. So you're trying to order God to do things in a certain way, as if he was your errand boy. "He trusted in God, let God deliver him. Now, if he will save him," after all, Jesus said, "I am the Son of God." "Even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him with the same thing." So these two condemned criminals dying on crosses adjacent to Jesus joined the crowd and said, "Yeah," as if they didn't have enough to worry about. Now, from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, there was darkness over all the land. Jesus was nailed to the cross at 9 in the morning. We know that from the other accounts. And at noon, precisely at noon, the whole sky went dark. Until the ninth hour, that means from noon until 3 p.m., it's totally dark. This is not an eclipse of the sun. This is a supernatural darkness that must have been terrifying to have the whole city go black as night, pitch. And this three-hour darkness, supernatural, we don't know what it was, would have been terrible and frightening to have no sunlight suddenly when you're walking around in daylight and suddenly the sky has turned dark until 3 p.m. And then Jesus cries out, "Eli, Levi, lama sabachthani," which translates from the Arabic into, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" For the first 3 hours on the cross, Jesus said 7 things from the cross, spaced over this 6 hours. For the first 3 hours, he was the great high priest, praying and interceding for Israel as the great high priest and the victim. At noon, the victim, Jesus became the victim of the sacrifice, and the sins of the whole world were laid on him. And he struggled with that for 3 hours. 3 hours in earth time, all this going on in eternity. The sufferings of Jesus on the cross are eternal. They're outside of time. They poke themselves into time a little bit. So we have to see beyond 6 hours to things going on outside of time. Jesus is the Lamb of God slain before the foundation of the world. So this is a very marvelous, profound event in history. This makes Jesus, the death of Jesus on the cross, the central focus of all of history. And of course, the cross is found in many churches and necklaces around necks and symbols everywhere, but and all of that calls our attention to the real Jesus. At the end of, by the way, reading and studying these seven words from the cross, sometimes they used to have an Easter service where these would be, you have maybe different speakers come in and each speaker would meditate on one of the seven words from the cross. It'd take the whole afternoon. It's very interesting to dig out those seven petitions. As I said, the first set of petitions were prayers for the world. The last set of predictions are the victim crying out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? So this is the first time in the life of Jesus when he has been forsaken by the Father. He's always had this intimate relationship with the Father. He knew the night before at Gethsemane that this was going to happen, and now it's happened. And we can't even begin to imagine how the horror of Jesus being turned into a sacrificial victim. He who knew no sin was made to be sin for us so that we might become the righteousness of God in him. To have all of the sins of all of mankind placed on Jesus as a cosmic sacrifice is staggering. You can't even imagine it. The billions of people that have lived and died, Jesus is absorbing all their sins and carrying them out of the universe. And he's like the scapegoat back in the services of the temple when the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies once a year and offer up sacrificial blood to for all the people, and outside the two goats, one goat would be slain for the blood and the other goat would be driven out into the wilderness. The high priest would lay his hands on that scapegoat, throw him out of the wilderness, and the scapegoat would carry the sins of the people symbolically out of way. All of these things in the Law of Moses are pictures of what Jesus did on the cross. So there's much, much here that you can study. I've already mentioned Psalm 22. Psalm 22 by David is a picture of all the things that Jesus felt on the cross. We better study that before we're through. Where did I stop? Jesus, the last words from Jesus are next to the last. He's got one more saying here. Some who heard, stood there, when they heard that, said, this man is calling for Elijah. Immediately, one of them ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. Here you take a long stick with a sponge on the end of it and you dip it in sour wine, that's vinegar, and you give it to the condemned man because he's thirsty. He's in agony, and maybe you can just give him a wet sponge with vinegar on it and help him ease his suffering.
That wasn't to mock him? Wasn't to mock him giving him that? I mean, that wouldn't taste good.
Well, this is one of the soldiers there. Probably the guards and soldiers feel some compassion for Jesus. He's going to die anyway, so maybe as the last thing we could do, let's give him a little sour wine on, because he's thirsty.
Did he have any water that you give him?
The rest of them said, let him alone. So the other people around there said, don't give Jesus any vinegar, even a sponge of vinegar, a few drops of vinegar. Leave him alone. Let him alone. See if Elijah will come to save him. The coming again of Elijah is predicted in the Bible, that Elijah would come before the great and terrible day of the Lord. That's still unfulfilled. So here these skeptics are saying, he can't save himself. Maybe Elijah will come and take him down from the cross and save him. Jesus, when he had cried out again, yielded up his spirit. He dismissed his spirit as an act of his own will. His life was not taken from him. He dismissed it. Knowing that the sufferings of the sins of the world was over, he said, "Okay, God," and he died. And at that point, his spirit went back to the Father. His body went into the tomb for 3 days. So that's all the stuff that we can figure out here just by a little detective work. When he had cried out in a loud voice, he gave up the ghost. He yielded up his spirit. And at that same moment, it's still dark, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth quaked and the rocks were split. The graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the graves after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. When the centurion in charge of the soldiers and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and the things that were happened, they feared greatly, saying, "Truly, this was the Son of God." So the crowd, the centurions particularly, are, "Oh, wow, what have we just done?" Because there is a great earthquake. Jerusalem has big earthquakes. They are on the biggest fault line, runs up from Africa to Turkey through the Dead Sea. And it's earthquake-sensitive country. So there's a great earthquake at the moment Jesus dies. In the temple in Jerusalem, the veil, heavy big veil between the holy place and the Holy of Holies, is rent, is torn from top to bottom, exposing the Holy of Holies to public view for the first time in centuries, and showing, as the book of Hebrews talks about, that a new and living way has been made for us sinners to come into the Holy of Holies, into the presence of God.
Now we have a direct connection with God. Now that meant we had a direct connection with God. We had a direct connection with God.
We have a direct connection with God. We don't have a mediator anymore.
Yeah.
We don't have a high priest. We don't stand outside in fear and trembling. This is discussed at length in the book of Hebrews. It's a beautiful picture here. The temple veil was torn in top. The earthquake, the rocks were split. So there must have been a lot of noise and clamoring in Jerusalem. And you can maybe see the father heart of God in this, that God does not appreciate. God has emotions. He cares. He feels. This is his beloved son. He's just given his beloved son over to be killed as a sacrifice for sins. Jesus volunteered. He knew what he was in for. So this is the father and the son working together in an intimate way to solve the problem of human evil. The graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. Coming out of their graves after the resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. We don't know whether these saints were raised from the dead like Lazarus was and lived out their lives and died again. We don't know they could have been raised to eternal life. We don't know who they are. They're not identified. But we know here that one of the tokens that God showed here after the death of Jesus was a token resurrection, which would be a picture of the great resurrection which is to come, in which all those who believed in Jesus would be raised from the dead. Not then, but now. Thank God we've waited 2,000 years because we are on that list. When the centurion and those with him were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and the things that had happened, they feared greatly, saying, "Truly, this was the Son of God." Many women who followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, were there looking on from afar. Oh, interesting. The women always followed Jesus, took more interest in him than the disciples did. The disciples all ran away. The women were there when he was crucified. They're going to assist in his burial now. And there's a lot of them. There's not just a few. They're hanging around. And they're not afraid to look at all this going on. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons, James and John. So we have these specific women who are there. They believed in Jesus, they followed him. When evening had come, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself also had become a disciple of Jesus. Joseph of Arimathea was rich, and he was from a town down near the coast, Mediterranean. And he's, I think, a member of the Sanhedrin. And he's very prominent, a citizen of Jerusalem. And he says, hey, I want to bury Jesus. It's not lawful to leave a condemned prisoner unburied when the Sabbath is coming in. And this is now 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and it's going to get dark. So Joseph of Arimathea, who's watching all this, says, and he had been a disciple of Jesus, said, went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. And Pilate commanded the body to be given to him. Oh, yeah, get rid of Jesus. Get him buried. Get him out of here. Let's forget all that's happened here. It's an ugly point in history. When Joseph had taken the body, he wrapped it in a clean linen cloth. I met a man the other day who studies the Shroud of Turin. He's convinced the Shroud of Turin is legitimate, and he thinks that the tablecloth from the table in the upper room was what they grabbed and used to carry Jesus to his tomb. The body would have been taken down from the cross, bleeding and bruised and bloody from all of the torturing. And so you don't have a coffin or a casket or an ambulance. You have to just hastily carry the body of Jesus to a tomb and get it buried by sundown, which is going to be a few hours. So that seems to be... Now, people like Hal Lindsey insist that the wrappings of Jesus were circular, like you wrap a mummy. I don't think anybody knows. The Shroud in Turin is an ancient piece of linen cloth in Turin, Italy, that shows the marks of a body on it. It's been studied a lot. Nobody knows. Doesn't much matter. God does not ordinarily leave relics around, like Noah's Ark and things like that. Anyway, they take Jesus down from the cross, drape him or carry him away in this tablecloth, and they lay him in his new tomb. Joseph of Arimathea says, use my tomb. He's a rich man. He has a very expensive tomb prepared for him and for his family. The Jewish burial custom back then is to bury the body without embalming it and let it decay and come back in a few weeks, few months, and take the bones and put them in an ossuary, which is a box made out of marble or limestone, and put that box of whoever it is in the family tomb where all the family's box bones are buried. So that's the Jewish burial custom. Chuck Missler points out here that Joseph of Arimathea was willing to let Jesus have his tomb, but only for the weekend. And that's kind of humorous. We don't know. Joseph of Arimathea is willing to give up his own family tomb to bury Jesus in. We know from that area on the mountain that there are today the tombs of a lot of poor people. But the garden tomb is not the tomb of a poor person. It's the tomb of a rich man. So they wrapped the body and in a clean linen cloth and laid it in his new tomb, which he had hewn out of the rock. And he, Joseph of Arimathea, rolled a large stone against the door of the tomb and departed. These are big circular tombs like millstones that you roll across in a trough to close the door of the tomb. If you look up the garden tomb in Jerusalem, you'll see the trough. That stone isn't there, but you can see other tombs. Okay, so now Jesus is dead, buried, and it's sunset on Friday. and everybody goes home, and the Sabbath comes in, and the next day is this day of rest. Mary Magdalene was there, the other woman sitting opposite the tomb. So Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and mother of Zebedee's son, James and John, watch this burial. They're there. It's getting dark. On the next day, and the next morning is Saturday, no work on Saturday, the Sabbath. But nevertheless, we've got the body buried so it's out of sight, and we're not desecrating the Sabbath, but let's go make sure that Jesus has been properly anointed with herbs. We don't embalm the body, but we do put spices on it. The day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered together in private. Meanwhile, back in town, some of these people that hate Jesus so much think, what are we going to do to cover our tracks? How are we going to hide this? Pilate, we remember while he was still alive how that deceiver said, after 3 days I will rise. Oh, Pilate, we got to pay attention to this, because that Jesus said he was going to come back in 3 days. Well, it's not very likely, but we got to cover our bases here.
Lambert.
Therefore, command that the tomb be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come by night and steal him away, and say to the people, he has risen from the dead. So the last deception will be worse than the first. Not very likely. The disciples didn't have that much guts. They didn't believe he was going to come back from the dead. But it made a very good story to be passed on down for 2,000 years, till some people still believe the body of Jesus was stolen away and hidden, which is ridiculous considering how broken it was and how dead he was.
Amber, this passage here, after 3 days, I will rise. You know, they said that, the Jews. Because it seems like here they're actually acknowledging that they knew what Jesus was actually saying, destroy this temple and I will rebuild it in 3 days.
That's right.
When they actually tried to use it against him and say they were actually trying to destroy the physical temple.
Very good, so Dave. That's absolutely correct. And there's a lot in history that this story did circulate, and a lot of people bought that story. And no evidence whatsoever that anybody tampered with the tomb. It was guarded, as you'll see here. Pilate said, you have a guard. You have soldiers. Go your way. Make it as secure as you know how. Go make sure. Take some soldiers. Guard the tomb. Lock it up tight. Make it so secure that nobody could get in. They went and made the tomb secure, sealing the stone and setting the guard. So that would have been happened on Saturday morning. So there were soldiers guarding the tomb. The women were on their way, hoping to get the body wrapped up properly and with spices. And then the tomb door is sealed, rolled in place, and sealed with Romans. You go to a crime scene, the police will put a tape around the thing to show that nobody's been in the crime scene. Well, I don't know how they sealed the tomb with the seal, but they did, and they put soldiers on guard just in case. Just as a safety measure. Well, Dave points out that Jesus had said to them that he would rise again on the third day, and they were terrified, disbelieving but terrified. I think we should stop there. And obviously we're going to come now to chapter 28 next week.
Okay. Can I just make a couple little notes
please.
So here in 27 verse 57, where Joseph buries or they use Joseph's tomb to bury Jesus, in John 19:39, it makes a mention of Nicodemus coming with something, I can't remember what it was, but I think that was an indication that Nicodemus actually did come to know Christ and acknowledged him as his Lord and Savior. And so this is kind of missing in Matthew, but it's here in John. And also another little footnote, in Matthew 27:44, even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him. So one thing that was left out is also, is in Luke 23:40, where one of them actually acknowledged that he was Christ. And, you know, he says, then one of the criminals who were hanging blasphemed him, saying, if you are the Christ, save yourself and us. But the other answered, rebuking him, saying, do you not even fear God, seeing you are under the same condemnation? So in Luke, we find out that one of those two that was hanging on the cross actually came to recognize that he was God. And Jesus said to him, surely I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise.
This very day, you're going to go with me to paradise. That's very insightful, because it shows that when Jesus dismissed his spirit, he went immediately to heaven. The repentant thief went with him, and they were with Jesus in paradise immediately. Well, that raises a lot of questions of that are full of mystery, but you're absolutely right.
So the passage about Nicodemus, it says, and Nicodemus, who at first came to Jesus by night, also came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds. 100 pounds.
100 pounds.
Myrrh. So, I mean, that's like very insightful. Everything he had.
Nicodemus in chapter 3 came to Jesus by night and asked about how knowing God, and that's when Jesus gave that famous message about being born again. And, and Nicodemus was in the Sanhedrin, as I remember, and he was a secret believer, but he kind of comes out of the closet here and is not afraid of risking his reputation by identifying himself with Jesus. So this is I think next week we could finish up Matthew. I'd like to do the same account from Luke's Gospel, and maybe from John, in order to round this all out, because we don't get the whole story in any one gospel, as you point out. Okay?
All right.
Father, thank you very much for our time together today. And it's been long and convoluted and involved, and it's powerful. But thank you that this is recorded history, that this is reality, that our relationship with you puts us in your family as one of your followers. So help us to just take this all in and realize what it is you've done for us. In the name of Jesus.